Welcome to PNC C-Speak, the language of executives, a podcast created to share the stories of the most successful, innovative, and inspirational leaders in Los Angeles. I'm Josh Schimmels, publisher and CEO of the Los Angeles Business Journal, here with my co-host, Todd Wilson, regional president of Greater Los Angeles for PNC Bank.
Thanks, Josh. It's always a pleasure. And I'm particularly excited about today's guest. Our guest today doesn't just analyze the economy, he helps define how we understand it. He's someone who's shaped the economic conversation in California for more than a decade. He's helped leaders across sectors make smarter, data-informed decisions.
From housing shortages to labor market shifts and federal policy to state-level innovation, his voice has been one of the most respected and trusted in the field of economic forecasting. At the helm of the UCLA Anderson Forecast, he's helped Los Angeles and California navigate some of the most uncertain and transformational periods in recent history.
Under his leadership, the forecast has evolved into a powerhouse of insight, expanding to include experts in development, global trade, digital media, and finance. It's an institution that now reflects the complexity and energy of the California economy.
And through it all, his focus has remained consistent, helping leaders. He's not just forecasting numbers. He's helping shape how we prepare, respond, and lead. Dr. Jerry Nicholsberg, welcome to C-Speak.
Thank you for that kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here with PNC C-Speak and with you all this morning.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you for taking the time. The work you've led at UCLA Anderson has been such a critical resource for business leaders and policy leaders alike. You've helped guide the forecast through some incredibly complex economic moments. Looking back, what are you most proud of in how your team supported decision makers throughout those times?
I think there are a number of things. Looking back, I'm really proud of, and it's really my team. It is a crack team of economists and support personnel. What we've been able to do is evidence-based, data-based analysis and interpretation of what's happening in the economy, try to raise the level of discourse for decision makers, both in the business community and in government.
Forecasting during unprecedented events is a huge challenge, I'm sure. How do you approach balancing long-term economic models with short-term shocks that can upend almost anything?
When you do forecasting, you try to come up with the most likely scenario. For example, in times like today, when we have changing policy on a daily basis, you have to do that and also explain what are the risks to the forecast. How do you understand those risks? How do you make decisions based on them and pivot as data unfolds, data that we were not expecting, but as evidenced of recent times, we see pretty often these days.
You mentioned your team. During your tenure, you've expanded the forecast team to include experts in development, digital media, economics, and finance. What inspired this growth on your team, and how has having such diverse expertise changed the way that you're able to interpret and communicate economic forecasts?
Well, we thought that we could expand and really drill down into the regions of California, do what we were doing for the state of California with an expanded team. You talked about the diverse set of economists that we have. One of the things that we really work hard on is taking the politics out, taking the media narrative, if you will, out, and looking at the data and saying, what does economics tell us? What does the data tell us? And where does that lead us in terms of interpreting how the Los Angeles economy, the California economy, the Bay Area economy, and so on, is going to evolve?
So would you say the data leads all?
Not exactly. Data is very important, but just taking in data, and this is one of the issues with big data, you also have to have a structure to interpret the data. Mm. And so we very much emphasize the use of economic theory. And as my predecessor, Professor Ed Lehmer, used to say, we need the story, and the story is the economic theory. How does this data hold together to give us insight as to how the economy is evolving and what the future might hold?
You know, it's interesting you talk about economic theory, but I presume that's also focused on some sort of predictable decision making, which in today's world isn't necessarily predictable. How do you think about that?
So that's exactly right. And coming back to the notion of data, the forecaster's problem is to say, if the future is like the past, here's the most likely outcome. Today, the data generated is being generated on a set of policies we have not seen before, which makes that data less reliable and forces us to do our interpretation with more reliance on the structure, on the economic theory, on the story of how it all hangs together than we did 5 years ago.
It's more of a craft today, isn't it?
I think it always has been. So, you know, an important part of this is we give a point forecast, a number for GDP growth, for unemployment, for retail sales, and so on. But it's really important to understand that number is the most likely, but we're going to be wrong. We hope we're not very wrong. We hope that it's close to that number. But we have to understand what are the things that might happen. We really need to assess how likely are those events to occur, and how does government, how do businesses create decisions that take into account that those things might occur.
You've been doing this a long time and very successfully. Can you talk about your efforts to grow and support the next generation of economists, how you've been mentoring them? What skills and perspectives do you hope they have to meet the challenges ahead?
Mentoring is critically important. And it's one reason why when everyone was saying the office is dead, no one's going back to the office, I said, how can you have mentoring on virtual platforms? Mentoring really is person to person. We hire our economists out of graduate school or shortly out of graduate school with a new PhD. They have a lot of techniques, a lot of technology. We really try to immerse them in the real world, what's happening on Main Street and on Wall Street, and how we use all of those things that we learned in school to do a better job in interpreting what is happening in the real world. And that's a process that takes time.
You talk about your focus on California and how you do that, but there's national level decisions that are impacting California, from supply chain disruption to shifts in immigration policy. What decisions at the national level do you think will have the most meaningful impact on our economy here in California?
So immigration policy, tariff and tax policy, right? California is a very diverse economy. It's well integrated with the rest of the world. Keep in mind that the United States, and this includes the state of California, is less dependent on international trade than most countries. But we are highly dependent on it. We sit on the Pacific Rim. We have large ports. And so tariff policy is quite important. But California is also a microcosm of the U.S. So national policy directly affects the state. And we pay a lot of attention to national policy and indeed create a national forecast.
For our C-suite leaders tuning in, what would you say they should be paying the closest attention to in what we're seeing as an ongoing and constant shifting landscape?
So the first thing I would say is ignore the pundits, look at the data and really think about the data and how does it hold together. For example, in 2023, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates, and the vast majority of economists were saying we're going to have a recession. Actually, the third quarter of 2023 was where the predictions were the highest probability. We looked at this data in a wider context by saying, you know, interest rates are going up, but are they going up to abnormal levels or normal levels? They were going up to normal levels. We looked at what sectors are being impacted. Interest rates normally affect housing and durable goods manufacturing. In both cases, we were underproducing. We were underproducing homes, underproducing in areas that interest rates would affect. And so we concluded that, yes, interest rates are going up. That's going to have an impact. And indeed, we saw it in real estate sales. Boomers were not selling their houses because they had 3% mortgages, but there was no indication of a recession. And that's kind of the advice is look at the data and look at it in a wider context. It's not the immediate things where Wall Street is trying to elicit information out of the latest little piece of data. But look at the longer sweep of the data and of the economy.
So whether it's in Washington or Sacramento or rural America, two topics we hear a lot about these days are tariffs and interest rates. They can be political. They can also be real economic issues. Just talk about that for a second.
Sure. So let me talk about tariffs first. The ostensible reason for these tariffs are to level the playing field, to create more national security, for example, by bringing certain things like medical PPP back to the U.S. so that it's not being produced by a potential adversary, and to deglobalize somewhat and really change the structure of the U.S. economy. A common misconception is that tariffs are going to be paid by the exporter. All of the data tells us that's absolutely false. The tariffs are a sales tax, so it's a tax on consumption by the functionality of the thing we're consuming. A tariff is a tax on some goods based on their origin, but it's a sales tax paid ultimately by the consumer. And so the tariffs are a tax on the U.S. economy. But the idea is to back away from where the economy has been going for some 25 to 30 years of globalization. Now, we know that process had a lot of disruption costs, and we see it particularly in the Midwest in the rusting former factory buildings, right? Yeah. Moving to a different structure of our economy, whether you like that or not, is going to have disruption costs. But the plan is to move to that kind of economy. And so in the near term, we're going to have higher taxes on foreign goods. We're going to have disruption because resources that have been used to import those goods, for the distribution of those goods, for retailing them, our consumption of them, that's going to change. It doesn't change overnight. Those resources, human resources and capital resources, have to move into the new sectors that will be growing ultimately when and if this goal is achieved. So that's what's happening with, you know, with tariffs.
But in the medium term, the presumption is that it's effective in growing the U.S. economy internally.
Generally, when there is disruption, you get the opposite effect.
Okay.
Just for example, when factories closed in Ohio, Ohio didn't grow fast. People were unemployed. If East and West Coast ports and Gulf ports start shrinking, there are going to be people who are unemployed. Okay. So there are going to be costs to this. And that is the way a capitalist economy will adjust itself to the new reality. So in the near term, expect slower economic growth. That also goes along with higher taxes. So even if you get the kind of growth that you were just speaking about, that's not the near term. That is after the economy is adjusted and then starts growing from that new base.
This may be more of a political question than an economic question, but do the tariffs stick? Are they a negotiating point? How do you think this kind of comes out in the middle term?
There are three different kinds of tariffs. There are national security tariffs. Think about certain sophisticated silicon chips, processors, medical devices, defense equipment, etc. Those tariffs go on and stay on. Rare earths is another example. There are penalty tariffs. Those are tariffs that are put on because the country producing the good is not engaging in fair trading practices. Mm-hmm. An example of that is if there is a manufacturer in the U.S. who's producing a good that has some toxic waste, they're required to properly dispose of that toxic waste. If a manufacturer in another country whose cost structure is no different from that in the U.S. also produces toxic waste but dumps it in the river, that's an unfair advantage. Those tariffs stick. Then there are tariffs that are negotiating tariffs. It seems that the bulk of the tariffs, not all of them, but the bulk of them, are negotiating tariffs. They have a near-term impact because during the negotiations, which can stretch out for a very long period of time, there are these 90-day hiatuses, but they can be rolling.
Yeah.
There's nothing in the law that says they have to be 90 days. A company that doesn't know their cost structure is not going to invest, is not going to produce as much. They're going to take a defensive strategy. And a perfect example that's very relevant for California is home building. We get about 70% of the inputs, if not the entire drywall, from Mexico. Almost all our electrical fixtures, light bulbs, switches, couplings, and so on, from China. We get 70% of our lumber from Canada. A home builder who doesn't know what those key components cost, how can you make a plan? You only do the things where you have high margins, because those margins might be dramatically squeezed. And so those negotiating tariffs, until the negotiations are over with and it looks like it's resolved, are going to have an impact on the economy.
I know it's not perfectly apples to apples, but California economy has continued to grow strong. Now the fourth largest economy in the world. with Los Angeles being even a huge portion of that. What are the key drivers behind this ranking, and what should our audience and business leaders understand about the strengths and vulnerabilities that come with that?
Yeah, so let me start off by saying the comparison of a state GDP with national GDPs across the world is kind of fraught with problems. But California is a very big economy, and it dwarfs most other countries in terms of the goods and services that are produced here. California has always been an innovative state. And we think of Silicon Valley, but also in aerospace, in medical technology, in agricultural technology and entertainment. And it's that innovation that is so characteristic of California, combined with the fact that California has always been much more of an entrepreneurial state. Immigration to the state has been, whether it's domestic or international, by people who wanted to start something new. And that's created this culture that I think has driven rapid economic growth. Adding to that, California has a huge college and university system, larger than anywhere else, more engineers, more scientists, more innovators between the University of California system, the California State system, and the 103 community colleges. So you've got an ecosystem here that is kind of a virtuous cycle of growth.
Access to great talent, I think, is where you're going with that. Access to talent, access to research facilities, so much within those university systems.
That's right. And speaking with CEOs or managers of factories that are being built in California, asking them, why are you building in California with its tax structure, with all of the problems that we know? And the answer is, there is a deeper pool of talent here than anywhere in the world. If you need to grow, you can do it here. Mm. If you're in smaller markets that, you know, have been touted, the next Silicon Valley, for example, the talent gets exhausted. There are good people there, but it's a limited pool. And here the pool is very large.
I assume hand in hand with that is Silicon Valley is obviously the venture capital of the world. So therefore, access to capital probably comes along with that as well, right?
That's right. And in each of these industries, you have an ecosystem that's developed. And if you take aerospace here in Southern California, that's another ecosystem. And, you know, speaking of this talent, the medical technology industry in California really started with the contraction of the aerospace industry in the 1990s, where very talented engineers were finding that their industry was contracting, but they had the skills and could rely on talent from the local colleges, universities, and community colleges to build new businesses. So that's key to the state.
We talked about California's significance in the global economic footprint. More locally, how should businesses think about their role on this world stage?
We don't really know 5 years from now where the United States is going to be vis-a-vis the world stage. However, we have a population in California that is connected to countries throughout the world. There's a lot of change going on now. Change brings risk, but it also brings opportunities. So I think kind of leaning into that and thinking about, well, are there opportunities here that I do understand?
As we compare the region on a bigger level, in what ways would you say the California economy is either diverging from or aligning more closely with national trends? Because I know you mentioned that in some ways it mirrors it, but I have to imagine in other ways it doesn't.
Typically, California leads the U.S. This last year, there's been a real slowdown. A big part of that has been a contraction in the entertainment industry and a restructuring in the tech industry in the Bay Area. But typically, California leads the U.S. New technologies are developed here. New ways of manufacturing are developed here and exported to other parts of the U.S. Where land is less expensive, or there is a different kind of talent that allows folks to develop those resources. So California tends to lead the U.S. and tends to export the knowledge base that is developed here.
So coming even more localized for a second, let's talk about Los Angeles. Los Angeles, given its size, has more middle market companies than any city in the country, has more small businesses than any city in the country. But many of these are dealing with the aftershocks of the pandemic, wildfires, high interest rates, inflation. What challenges and opportunities do you see for these small businesses here locally?
So I think the challenges are huge. And current economic policy makes it difficult for small businesses. But focusing on that niche, on that uniqueness of the product or service, I think is important. So Los Angeles has always been a place of reinvention. It makes it a very unique city, a very unique economy. And so thinking about it in that sense of reinventing, and LA after the 90s, after the aerospace contraction, reinvented itself. Again and again, it reinvents itself. I think we're in that kind of period now, and there are risks, but there are going to be opportunities, and one should search them out. And those opportunities may be things that we aren't even thinking about today, but it is a dynamic regional economy.
How can companies use economic forecasts more effectively in things like strategic planning and decision making? What advice would you give?
So I think the first piece of advice is define why you want that forecast. State and local government needs to make a forecast to create a budget. Why do they want the forecast? They want to know what they're going to be able to spend the next year, what kinds of public services they can provide. However, it is much more painful to overestimate the revenue you're going to get than it is to underestimate. If you have more money than you expected, that's kind of a good thing, and you can do things with that. If you have less, you have to cut. That forecast only gives you a midpoint. Because of that asymmetry in the risk rewards, we always recommend that state and local governments look at that forecast, and then they use something much more conservative in their budgets. The state government is now doing that. At least the executive branch is doing that. Businesses, you know, kind of need to look at that. Now, a business that is risk-taking is going to look at that very differently. So that's unique to the decision process. And you start off by saying, why do I want the forecast in the first place?
So let's look forward to 2026 and beyond. Focus down on two or three economic indicators that business leaders can look for more closely when they're trying to plan out their growth or prepare for risks.
Obviously, the business leader wants to look at what's their revenue going to be. What are their costs, in particular labor costs? So looking at the labor force and looking at demographics is going to be important. Now, California has had a constant population for the last few years. Population's growing a little bit. I would pay attention to H-1B visas. Who is going to be moving to California? What's going to be that structure of the labor force? How will immigration policy affect the state and affect my business? So that's one of the things that I would look at. A second thing that I would look at is how are new technologies evolving? And those technologies are going to be labor-saving technologies. You think AI and robots, but also other technologies, particularly in the service area. How is that going to impact my business? A third is what's going to happen with housing and the cost of living. California has a shortage of housing. California is also a wonderful place to live, and so people will pay a premium. So California's always had more expensive housing than the rest of the country for that reason. Is the state going to foster enough building? And of course, after the wildfires, that's even more critical. So those are kind of the things that I would look at to judge what is that economic environment going to be as I move through 26, 27, 28 timeframe.
Technology. I mean, we know that business in general and industry in general is embracing technology and using it in so many different ways. Is there a home for AI in forecasting and business strategy? What are your thoughts on that?
So next year, if you do this podcast and invite me and it's an AI bot, that would answer your question.
Well, you said robots too, right?
Yeah. Is there a future for AI in forecasting? You know, I think one of the things that makes AI so powerful is that it assists us in doing those tasks that are kind of laborious. They may involve some critical thinking, maybe a lot of critical thinking, but they're laborious. And so it can speed the incorporation of lots of data and make suggestions as to how that data fits together. But AI will hallucinate. AI is only as good as it's been trained to be. And going back to something we talked about earlier, AI, like forecasters, relies on past data. in an environment that's rapidly changing and the world is rapidly changing now, not just policies in Washington, but in many other ways, you need to be able to look at that data and say, yes, but the current data is not like the past data. So how do we reinterpret that? And I think it's going to be hard for AI to catch up, but it will help in accumulating and assimilating diverse data, and maybe data that we don't look at today because it takes too much time and we have limited time.
Are there common misconceptions that you think a lot of business leaders have about forecasts that you want to caution about or put out there?
Well, I don't know if they're misconceptions. A lot of forecasts that you hear of, that I read in the media, are opinions. They may be informed opinions, but they're opinions. And so they're not real forecasts in the sense of being evidence-based forecasts. And I think that's the cautionary note. Ask about why. Ask about what the definition of the data is. Kind of in my career, I've been surprised at how many times the definition of the data is different from what the individual speaking about the data thinks it is. Be careful with data and always ask, well, you know, how was that data collected?
Well, it sounds like some of it might just be in being cautious of defining the term forecast versus opinions and thoughts that, again, even if they're educated opinions and thoughts, may not quite be the same as data-driven forecasting.
That's correct. And there's a continuum of this, right? So going back to my comments about why do you want the forecast, sometimes why you want the forecast means an opinion or an informed opinion or a highly informed opinion is everything you need. So it really depends on how you're using that forecast, what it's going to do for you, what are the risks of being wrong?
I think that's a helpful perspective for our listeners. What are the risks of being wrong?
So we talk about California economy being both dynamic and resilient in terms of its ability to reinvent itself. What are some of the risks that C-level business leaders should not overlook despite the state's economic success?
They should not overlook what is happening in the legislatures, the city councils. So, you know, one of the roles of government is to create a structure. And that structure is not static, not nationally, certainly not locally. And so I think one wants to be very cognizant of how that structure is changing and how is that going to affect my business, maybe not in a year, maybe not in 2 years, but kind of over the longer term.
So obviously, you've been doing this forecast for a while and have been successful at it. What role do you think the economists and institutions like UCLA Anderson play in shaping the future of businesses?
I hope we play some role in terms of what I hope happens. So one of the additions to our staff has been a climate change economist who's never done forecast before, but has been now studying how to incorporate a changing climate into a forecast for the California economy. We know this is going to be increasingly important. So we know we've got issues of water and wildfires and sea level rise, all of these things that are going to impact the state. That is something we should be cognizant of. And so combining that with what do I do as a business? How is the governmental structure going to be changing in light of this? Is important in defining the landscape in which business is going to be conducted in the not too distant future.
So I'm going to ask you a question, put you on the spot. As I look at the California economy in the next 18 to 24 months, are you buying or are you selling?
Okay, so how are we doing on time?
We got plenty of time. We're going to
answer. Okay, but I'm going to answer a different question. All of the data is telling us the California economy is in for a bumpy road over the next 12 months, maybe 18 months. The growth that we've seen in 2024 and going into 2025 has been based on healthcare, education, and government. And none of those are going to be growing. In the first 3 months of this year, the number of payroll jobs in California shrank. The last month, it was up by 17,000, not a big number. With a 19 million labor force, there is adjustment going on in California, in particular in manufacturing, in entertainment, and technology. There are bright spots. There's a lot of investment in AI and robotics and information technology. There's a lot of investment in aerospace, commercial aircraft, defense aircraft, and space vehicles. There are some bright spots, but California's in for a bit of a bumpy road for the next 18 months. Those things that I just mentioned are going to be part of how California goes back to superior economic growth faster than the U.S. growth. But the near term's challenging.
Jerry, thank you so much for sharing your insights today. Your perspective is invaluable, and we appreciate you taking the time to join us here on PNC C-Speak.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we appreciate your time. It's been a learning experience, different perspectives. We appreciate you sharing your insights. It's clear that you've got a passion for providing data and information. Thank you for taking the time to be here, and I know our listeners will appreciate it as well. On behalf of the Los Angeles Business Journal and PNC Bank, thank you all so much for listening. To ensure that you are notified about our future podcast releases, please be sure to subscribe or to follow. Thank you again. We look forward to hosting you on the next episode of PNC C-Speak, the Language of Executives.